Wood Mackenzie's online future-facing commodities forum is back for its third year. Join us online on March the 27th for an open discussion with our experts on renewables, EVs, and advanced battery technology. There'll be two events on that date, one during the day in the Asia-Pacific region, and one during the day in Europe and the Americas. So you should be able to find a time to suit you, wherever you are in the world. At either one, you'll be able to get insights from our unparalleled integrated coverage of the renewables, battery, and electric vehicles value chains. You'll be able to hear our industry-leading analysts unpack their forecasts for key future-facing commodities, including lithium, nickel, copper, aluminium, and rare earths. Learn how technology, geopolitics, and regulation are transforming the metals markets as we build an electrified future. To register, go to go.woodmac.com/FFCF2024. You can find the details in today's show notes. Hello and welcome to The Energy Gang, a discussion show about the fast-changing world of energy. I'm Ed Crooks. I'm joined today by Melissa Lott, who's the Research Director at Columbia University's Center on Global Energy Policy, and she's also a professor at Columbia's Climate School. Hi, Melissa. How are you? Welcome back.
Hey, Ed. Doing well. I just got back from Colorado, which was gorgeous, but I'm enjoying being back in the city this time of year. It's very nice.
Indeed, indeed. New York just starting to get to be pleasant, isn't it, around this time of year? And it's also my pleasure to welcome a new guest to the Energy Gang. We have Jessica Trancic, who's a professor at the Institute for Data, Systems and Society at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. Hi, Jessica. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Something we always like to do when we have new guests on the Energy Gang like yourself is to get them to talk a little bit about their careers, how they got involved in energy, and the path that led them to what they're doing today. So, Jessica, what was it for you? How did you get interested in energy, and how did you get to where you are now?
Yeah, so I did my PhD in engineering, but I had a long-standing interest in international development and sustainable development. And so after finishing my PhD, I worked for the UN for a bit in Geneva. And that's where I really formulated my interests in energy systems and working on energy and climate change, and really was driven by just the recognition that technology was very central to addressing the climate challenge, but that we could do more in evaluating technologies, anticipating which ones could be most beneficial in order to, you know, direct our development efforts in a more targeted and successful way. So that's what I started working on. I mean, of course, you're always uncertain about the future when dealing with technology development, but I just felt like there was room to kind of draw on my engineering background and then also some of my interests and background in policy in order to address that question. So that's when I started working in the field I'm in now and sort of developing the research area that I work in today on evaluating technologies and technological change using data-informed models. And I've been working in this area since then for over 20 years.
And I'll say in that 20 years, Jessica and I have been in the same ecosystem and touch points. I know I've followed your work for a long time, but had the opportunity, Ed, we started working together on the United Nations Council of Engineers for the Energy Transition together. Are we going on 2 years on that now, Jessica?
Yeah, almost.
Yeah, which has been a lot of fun. And it's wonderful when you have so many people working on different parts of this challenge from the engineering and the technical perspective in this case, coming all together for that work. So glad to be able to have this conversation today, Jessica.
Yeah, me too. And it's been really wonderful to interact with Melissa through that group and then also have this opportunity to speak with her and with you, Ed, today. One just quick thing I'll say about that group is it's great because it brings in perspectives from all around the world, from engineers, from various countries, really covering most regions of the world. And, you know, I think that's really important for where we are. I mean, it's generally always important, and I think it's really impactful for where we are right now in the clean energy transition.
Absolutely. Well, thanks very much for taking some time to talk to us today and to share some of your thoughts and insights in that area, which is really what I want to start off talking about. So what I want to ask you is the thing which I guess is the most annoying thing for any academic, which is explain to me everything you've learned and that you think is important about your field in 30 seconds. You know, as you say, so what you're studying is innovation and technology, and particularly as that applies to the energy transition and the development and deployment of clean energy technologies and how that's going to help address the threat of climate change. And in this first section of the show, what I want to do is talk a bit about policy and to think about different types of approach to energy policy and climate policy and to think about the Inflation Reduction Act and so on. But just before we get into any of those practical details, if you were to summarize your views on what the evidence shows about how best to support innovation, how you can drive innovation and get deployment of new technologies, particularly, I guess, in an area like energy, where it is so important to accelerate the deployment of a whole raft of new technologies, what does the evidence tell you?
Yeah, so I mean, I think this is really the key question, right? We have limited time. There's always constraints on our financial resources for addressing the challenge of climate change. And so it's really important to put our time and our efforts and our financial resources into promising solutions, but then you're always dealing with uncertainty, you know, which technologies are going to take off, which ones are going to be beneficial. There's always downsides to any technology. Can we anticipate those? Can we limit those? So those are all the kinds of questions that we try to, you know, work on in this research area and that I'm particularly interested in. I mean, I guess one relevant insight, if we think about the role of policy, let's say, in encouraging innovation and clean energy technologies, you know, what is that role and what's worked in the past? How did we get to where we are today with cheaper, high-performing solar energy, wind energy, batteries? You know, how did energy efficiency improve and so forth? So what have we learned about what worked there? We know that policies around the world were rather piecemeal. There wasn't as much global coordination as we might have liked. But nonetheless, there's been substantial technology innovation. So we looked at this and kind of developed a methodology. I won't go into too many details, but for looking at, you know, what really worked and what can we learn for the future. And so we started with looking at the level of the devices, the physics, how did they improve? And then from there, we can actually learn about what we call higher level mechanisms that drove these improvements. Now, we know that a lot of this started with policy because there was no incentive for the private sector to invest on its own, aside from some companies that felt this was important decades ago to start developing these clean energy solutions. But on the whole, there wasn't enough incentive for this market to really get going. So policy was critical there. And one of the important things we have learned from this research is that both government funding for research and development and government policies that stimulated market growth were very important because they drove different kinds of innovation. So they were complementary to one another, you know, and this goes back to a longstanding debate about whether government should be stimulating markets or should it focus entirely on research and development funding. But when you start with that engineering level, you see that both kinds of policies really play an important role in that market expansion policies kickstarted a lot of private sector competition and innovation. So it wasn't really policy or the private sector. There was actually this really interesting effect of policies jumpstarting a lot of innovation that led to improvement.
Can I say one thing that I've learned about innovation here in the last couple of decades I've been doing this? Putting it out there so y'all will disagree with me if you see it differently. The tech is cool. You have to get the ecosystem right. The ecosystem, I'm talking about policy, regulations, education, like there's so many components. I'm an engineer, first love right there. I do policy as well, and I have degrees in that, but the tech is cool. You got to get that ecosystem. Agree, disagree, shades of color on that statement. What do you guys think?
I definitely agree, Melissa. I think we can spend all of our time working in the lab, developing cool technologies, but what do people want? What do consumers value? What is going to take off and be adopted and so forth? I think that's really important. And that's really where that bridge to the private sector is key. Government-funded research can also support those kinds of analyses to really anticipate what technologies are going to be desirable to people. But bringing in the private sector is critical. And, you know, what we've seen from what's worked is really that policies that stimulated that interest in the private sector were very important.
And is it the case also that different types of policy are appropriate for different stages in the life cycle of a technology? So if I think about photovoltaic solar, for example, so that starts in the 50s, I guess, when they're putting solar panels on satellites, and then it's whatever it is, $10,000 per watt, and it comes down and down and down, and it gets to, I don't know, $100 a watt or $10 a watt, whatever it was. I mean, obviously, where are we now? Then 20 cents a watt or something like that, if you get a low-cost Chinese panel. But the subsidies and support for innovation and R&D and so on are a good idea for getting from $10,000 a watt down to $1,000 a watt. If you want to go from $1,000 to 20 cents, that's when, and certainly as was the case with solar, things that made a huge difference were Europe putting in place all of these feed-in tariffs, creating this very generous subsidy regime for solar power, and then also having basically open markets and the Chinese industry responding massively, having a huge increase in capacity and just working really aggressively to drive costs down to take advantage of that market, which was opening up first in Europe in the 2010s and then increasingly around the world as well. Have I just described the story of kind of solar development and solar innovation accurately, or was there more to it than that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good overview. We see that market growth was pretty steady from the early days, you know, the 70s, 80s. So you actually saw at the global level roughly exponential growth going way back. So that early market growth was really important too. And you had Japan with important policies that started these markets. And then you had Germany taking over, as you said, with the feed-in tariffs. China, the US also played a really important role in funding research and development throughout this period. So I agree with you that these different policies are important at different points along the development trajectory of these technologies. We do, though, see that it's beneficial to have continued investment in research and development along the way, some from government. I mean, that depends on the different technologies and the mechanisms that are important, which, by the way, we can analyze and try to anticipate. But you do see generally that R&D, both from government funding and private sector investment, is important along the way. But economies of scale really started to dominate the cost decline in solar in the last couple of decades. Overall, though, research and development was really important. And, you know, that continued investment in research and development was important. So I think the traditional picture of innovation and what's driving it has all of the important components. The interesting thing we see when we look at the details of these technologies is that, you know, you see some more research and development driven changes really being important all the way along the trajectory. We see that with lithium ion batteries as well, which is another technology that we've looked at in detail.
And what does that history of lithium ion batteries show?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's not all that different from solar modules. The role of policy is a bit more complicated because, of course, lithium-ion batteries are used in many different devices, and there were market forces driving their development, you know, with the development of information technology and so forth. But policy was also important for lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. But, you know, we really see, and this is work I did with Micah Ziegler, who, a former postdoc in my group that I just started on the faculty at Georgia Tech and is doing great work in storage. What we see when we look at that trajectory is just how important research and development was all along the way in developing these technologies. Now, I say these technologies because we have different kinds of lithium-ion batteries that came online. Now, we do see, again, as we saw with solar modules, that economies of scale had a very substantial impact in driving costs down in the last couple of decades. So it's something somewhat similar, but not exactly the same as solar. And then the other thing is, of course, energy densities were important to develop in the case of lithium-ion batteries.
So in the context of that, then, let's think about what the US government is doing today and the Inflation Reduction Act in particular. Given what we know, given what your research has found about history of innovation, what it takes for energy innovation to be successful, to drive down costs, to accelerate deployment. When I think about the Inflation Reduction Act, I think about it as having two kind of key salient features. One is that it's all about carrots rather than sticks. So it's about trying to incentivize low carbon energy rather than increase the burden on high carbon energy. And the other factor is that it's got a lot of detailed provisions for different types of technology. And so there'll be production tax credits and investment tax credits for wind and solar and storage. Then there's a different set of tax credits for low carbon hydrogen and different credits for carbon capture and storage and different credits again for nuclear, different credits and other regulatory incentives for EVs, which again are all changed by domestic content requirements and how much of the manufacturing is done within the US and so on. Does that make sense as an approach, do you think? If you were designing an optimal policy for the energy transition in the US. Would you do it this way?
Yeah. Well, you know, of course, one has to be pragmatic in terms of what policies are people willing to accept. We have limited time. Let's go with what works. I think that makes sense to a certain extent. With technology-specific policies, people may have an easier time seeing what's coming down the pike, so to speak. So that may be one reason why they're more acceptable in some contexts. So, you know, the policies that you described, Ed, are targeting specific technologies. It could be that that's, you know, something that's more acceptable, more popular, because we can kind of see what's coming. But of course, a carbon price does have some advantages, you know, in that it's more flexible. It allows for more competition. So I guess what I mean by flexible is it allows for the market to select across demand side changes like energy efficiency and supply side changes like different types of power plants. However, even when selecting a carbon price, we know to some extent, at least in the near term, what technologies will be favored. And that's because we know their costs in different markets. We know their carbon intensities. So it's actually pretty clear. So you can't actually get away from selecting technologies. Now, the argument is that you select a carbon price that's equal to the societal costs of those emissions, but that also requires making some forecasts about technology-specific evolution pathways. And then we come back to essentially what's required in designing technology-specific policies. You have to make these forecasts about what technologies are going to do, how they're going to perform, and deem which ones are more favorable. So there is still that challenge about evaluating and forecasting technology, even with a carbon price.
Right. That's a really interesting point. You mean, effectively, there's no such thing as a genuinely technology neutral policy, even if you're kind of trying to be technology neutral and just saying, well, this is the carbon price, and then let 1,000 flowers bloom and let everyone do what they want to do to adjust to that price. In practice, you're actually taking some views on which technology is favored and which aren't.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, when you're estimating those societal costs of carbon emissions, that's going to be at least in part determined by technology innovation. If you're selecting a carbon price at a given point in time, if it's $10 or $100 a ton, you know pretty well what effects that's going to have in terms of which techs the market will select. I'd love to hear Melissa's thoughts on this. And just to say that I really appreciate the work that you're doing at Columbia, which really bridges engineering and policy. And, you know, you bring your knowledge of technology to that work on policy evaluation. And I love how you guys are getting these messages out and these insights out to the public pretty quickly, and very relevant ones as well. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on this.
Yeah. So a couple of different things, and appreciate the kind words, Jessica, around the work. The team here is, I feel lucky to work with them because it's full of so many incredible folks who come at this with different lenses. And I think what those different lenses allow us to see is just how complex things are. We are not working from a blank slate. We all know that. There are so many different policies and regulations and incentive structures across all the different levels that affect how, why, where we adopt things, how different technologies may work or not in different sets of circumstances. It's really complex. So can a policy ever be truly technology neutral? I actually push back on the question around it, which is interesting, where a policy is not in a vacuum. It's not on a blank piece of paper. So that policy interacts with so many other policies. You end up creating things you can foresee and then other impacts that you may not have foreseen. Even if you study that policy really, really well, the knock-on effects are interesting, and it's a reflection of how complex our societies are, but also how complex our energy system is. I think back to the question, Ed, about like stuff, you know, that you didn't know when you started, now you know. I remember when I started studying carbon capture and storage, and it was presented to me as a way to get emissions out of the power sector, specifically attaching it to coal. And that was just how it was presented to me in the first, you know, sets of technical talks I got, because that was the application they were studying. But then when you expand it to the broader ecosystem and you think about, okay, I put a carbon tax or a price somehow effectively on carbon through whatever mechanism is your favorite or that your society chooses in your part of the world, But does that carbon capture actually deploy in power? No, it ends up deploying over an industry first in many, many, many cases. And then power may or may not benefit if, again, we have a commitment to go to net zero. So there's this other commitment you had to be there. When I started doing this work, it was talking about 50% reduction in emissions. 83% was this number we played with for a long time, right? And now it's net zero, and that has shifted the playing field. And so all of these things just have knock-on effects. So do I think that any policy we do is neutral? No, I mean policies are designed to have impacts and to achieve societal goals. So they do. Are they technology neutral? In isolation, in theory, you could design one that is. But Ed, how many times have I said there's theory and then there's practical pathways forward and the practical reality in which we live and we have to build this stuff? And it's just a lot messier. It's got politics, it's got preferences, it's got the things that aren't captured in the data that just we don't have in the data, the insights we don't have across a whole host of things. I was just discussing that with some of our data science colleagues, what we don't see in consumption data is one example. But overall, what I feel confident in saying, and I'm putting it out there actually with a little wobble in my voice because I'm curious what y'all are going to say to this, is compared to 20 years ago, rough numbers when I started this work, when it came to technology, I couldn't say confidently we have the techs we need to get mostly down the road, if not all the way down the road. We need to improve other things. Now, will innovation help? Absolutely. Do we want it and need it? Yes. Yes, let's do that. Are there going to be consequences we might not like if we deploy just the set we have today and don't have other options? Sure, all those things. I'm not making this as a blanket black and white statement, but the pathway to net zero is something we know a ton about and way more than we knew 20 years ago. And the innovations that have happened in the last 20 years has helped us to make some progress already. Whether it's the US power sector or something else you're looking at, we've made a lot more progress than I thought we were going to based on where technologies were 20, even 15 years ago.
Well, Jessica, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I agree that we're in a very different place from where we were 20 years ago, even just 10 years ago. And momentum is really built up in the marketplace. The transition is happening. The question is, how quickly will it happen? How will it affect people? You know, how equitably distributed will the benefits be? And, you know, all of those things are really important. And I think we should be focusing on those objectives when we think about technology innovation. We have a lot of the technologies we need. You know, if you do an engineering assessment of the costs of transitioning to a carbon-free energy system, carbon-free economy, we can get pretty far down that path, maybe to 80% emissions reduction, 90% with the technologies we have, with very little additional cost, with, you know, largely benefits rather than costs. However, the transition's not happening fast enough. There are probably costs that are not included in those assessments. So as you said, Melissa, the real world is a bit more complicated, but we can get a lot of the way there. There's still some, you know, what we call difficult to decarbonize end uses and energy services that I like to call currently more difficult to decarbonize, but it's a little bit too long. But just because I feel confident that we can find solutions to those energy services as well. But certainly innovation's needed there, but we also need that innovation on the technologies we have to make them more widely available, more attractive, so they can be adopted more quickly, and also to anticipate some of the downsides, as you were saying, Melissa, try to address those in this process of transition, because no technology is perfect. So yes, I agree fully. I think we've really come a long way and there's still, you know, so much to do. If you look at those technology improvement curves, we've come so far in some of these technologies like solar, more than 99% cost reduction, lithium ion batteries, more than 97%. You know, costs have just dropped so much, performance has gone up. But if you look at the emissions curves, of course, we're just, you know, leveling off. You know, can we say we're clearly bending that curve down? Maybe not, but that's what we need to do. We need to do it immediately. So innovation should focus on that, and then also the impacts on people, and not just climate change related impacts, but other impacts as well.
100%. And this is something, putting the people in the transition planning, putting the people in the middle of the technology, innovation, and development. I don't know about you, Jessica, like when I was studying engineering in my first degrees, like it was so focused on how the tech worked and it was less focused on the application. And granted, it's beginning of education, but when do you make that pivot? So yes, now I know how a cycle works. I know how refrigeration works and turbines work and power plants, and I know all that stuff. okay, but it's operating in what system, in what way? And then understanding consumer preferences. Just yesterday, I got asked in a class I was guest lecturing in, so is it nuclear or wind? And so I went through the whole soccer team analogy, going through some, you know, the things I talk about around actually you want to mix and you need firm power and variables cheap and da da da. But then it was one of those things where there's a fundamental question here though, which is let's say that those two technologies had the same characteristics from an engineering perspective. What does your community want? What are your priorities? What are the trade-offs you're okay with? On a nuclear perspective, I may not have or may not want to commit the amount of water I may need or the amount of other resources I may need. When it comes to wind, I may not have the land, much less be okay with using it, And so the preferences that we have is people who are living in the world, yes, we want energy, but we want more than that too. And whatever those things are, how does that factor in? So putting the human in the middle of the transition planning and how we talk about technologies in it. It's something that as a classical engineer, you know, I didn't start getting exposed to till later. It wasn't in my first degree, that's for sure.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think that's changing, but maybe not as quickly as we'd like to see in engineering education. I think it is changing. And, you know, at the end of the day, people are going to decide what technologies they want. You can have policy incentives, you can have engineers improving these technologies, but people will decide what they want. And I think as researchers, I feel our role is to put information out there and then people will make decisions. And hopefully that information can be useful in informing those decisions. And, you know, podcasts like this, of course, are really helpful in that way as well.
Yeah, that's a great point. That is very much something we are trying to do. I personally just had a completely different perspective on this just from this morning, because I've been at this conference, Distributech, which is this conference for the power transmission and distribution industry. And by the time this podcast gets released, I think that podcast will be available, published already. So do go back and listen to that if you're interested. But the theme that everyone's been talking about here is AI and nuclear fusion. And the connection between the two, and the sense that AI is both the sort of the cause of all the problems of the grid and the solution to them, arguably, because it's well known this, and something actually we should probably cover in more detail in a future episode, but the power load in the US, electricity demand in total in the US has been flat for a long time, a couple of decades, but really looks like it's going to start to kick off and accelerate. There was an exec from one of the big utilities speaking at this conference who was saying, you know, it used to be a big deal for us when we had a new load being added to the grid of 10 or 20 megawatts. Now we get several people coming saying we have a gigawatt, 1,000 megawatts of demand in a new data center, which we want to build for AI. Can you handle that increased load? And then you will hear people who are enthusiasts for AI and who think it's going to have an enormous future impact saying there is going to be then this massive extra spike in demand for energy, for electricity, created by all the wonderful applications that people are going to be able to use AI for. Maybe that's right. Then they go on to say, and also, so this is this big problem that's been created. Good news. Fusion will come along to solve this, and we'll have this unlimited, low-cost, low-waste nuclear power, and AI will help us find how to crack the secret of that, because if we apply artificial intelligence to the various knotty engineering problems around fusion power generation, AI will come up with all the answers, and we'll work out how to deploy that commercially at scale, which all struck me as interesting and perhaps a little bit removed from reality. But it did make me think about, as you say, that question of, you know, what can really be done with the existing technologies that we've got, and whether there is a sort of a tendency for people to want the Deus Ex Machina, the magic wand that could be waved and say, you know, this is going to be the thing that'll solve all of our problems. Doesn't matter how much extra load we add to the grid, because fusion power is coming and that'll make everything all right. And that then sort of takes away some of the momentum and the pressure and the demands for accelerated deployment of the technologies that we do actually have today, which are available, which can be rolled out at scale. But as you say, have the various downsides and possibly people don't want them or they cost too much or whatever it might be. Is that something you think about? Does that issue of kind of the perfect being the enemy of the good come up in your work?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. You know, I think we have to think about this problem of investing in climate solutions as a portfolio problem. And there are elements of that portfolio that could play a huge role. You know, if the cost of air capture goes way down. And if we can also solve the problems of air pollution, of combusting fossil fuels at the same time and get rid of that, that could play an important role. You know, and if we can find ways to cost effectively store that CO2 so that it definitely won't leak at all, even at slow rates, because if it does, we get back to the problem we started with. Fusion is cost competitive. You know, there are these kind of technologies that it's important to invest in, develop, but they really need to be only just one part of the portfolio because we have so much uncertainty. And I would say even what's called ambiguity. So uncertainty about uncertainty. We can't quantify that uncertainty really just yet. You know, people have an intuitive understanding of this. You hear that it's 30 years down the road and then 10 years later the same. So that's kind of a signature of this ambiguity. So, you know, these should be elements of our portfolio that we're investing in, but we really need to invest in other options that work, that can be deployed today, really understand how to make them most beneficial, attractive to people, and really continue to innovate along those lines to accelerate that process of adoption and also introduce benefits to society and address climate change. And I have a lot to say on AI as well, but of course, you know, there is potentially a lot of benefit for climate solutions for addressing climate change. I mean, just one that I'll highlight is that if we can make the demand for energy more responsive to the supply in a way that's extremely convenient for people that they hardly notice, that doesn't cause interruptions, or if it does, where they're compensated for those interruptions, that can be really helpful for this process of an energy transition. But of course, you have to consider the energy consumption of storing information, processing it. So that also has to be part of that conversation.
And so around all this innovation, technology diffusion, how we interact with technologies, what we choose, you know, if I go up to a higher level on it, it brings up the question of like, how quickly are we deploying the things that bring down all different types of air pollution emissions, Jessica. So, you know, I care a lot about particulate matter, NOx and sulfur oxides and others. And there's a lot of stuff in our air. But the greenhouse gas emissions, like how quickly are we moving to actually pivot this down? Because the impacts of not bringing down those emissions, of course, is very large. And when I think about AI and when I think about all this new tech, I just keep mentally coming back to the power sector and thinking about how much electricity we're going to need. How do we build that stuff out? Can we do it quickly enough to keep everything reliable, affordable, and clean and bring down emissions? So high-level meta comment there for you, Ed.
Indeed. And you were just looking at some data. You were talking about this before we came on. There's some new data out on what the US is doing in terms of progress on emissions reduction.
Yes, this is the fact sheet I was mentioning, or the fact book by the Business Council for Sustainable Energy. So they talked about 2023 emissions in the United States and how emissions in the US from the energy sector fell even as the economy grew. So I think overall the number was that the US economy grew by 2.4% and emissions dropped by 1.8%, falling in every sector, but drumroll please, transportation. It was interesting. So they broke it down, you know, record sales, record renewables, all this stuff. When it came to renewables, they talk about setting new highs and also how coal's contribution to power generation is down to just below 16% in 2023. That, for someone who started looking at these numbers in the US 20 plus years ago, that's just wow. To read that number out loud is pretty incredible.
Absolutely staggering, isn't it? Wasn't it? I mean, as recently as 2010, it was about 50%, right?
Yeah. So, Ed, if you look at the numbers and where it's gone, one thing I will highlight is they said point blank in this fact book that coal's contribution to power went down to just below 16%. It was 15.8%, they said on their numbers. And it was largely replaced with natural gas. Another statement that 15, 20 years ago, I would have been like, gas prices aren't that low. But of course, we all know what happened there. But two things I'll flag. One, transportation was the one part of this energy sector analysis where emissions didn't go down. But the numbers are saying that electric vehicle sales surged nearly 50% to almost 5 million vehicles sold in 2023. And there's those new federal EV incentives, there's price cuts, there's more models released. I would say as an EV owner, there's also more infrastructure to connect to, which is huge in my decision to actually buy that vehicle and use it. But putting it in broader context, if we look at the pace of emissions reductions, we're still not on track for climate goals. I'm hopefully celebrating, you know, what has been done. Like, that's impressive. That's great. If you asked me 15 years ago if we'd be here, again, that 15% number, no. Natural gas replacing coal, all these things. Like, I would have bet against me saying these phrases. But Under the Paris Agreement, the U.S. committed to reducing 50 to 52% compared to 2005 level baseline. And when we're looking at it, we're sitting at something like 16, 18% below 2005 levels. So those are big differences. But for me, going back to the headline number, economy grew as emissions fell. That's not insignificant. And all the stuff underneath it is really encouraging. And it goes back to just a ton of innovation that happened over decades of investment that led us up to this place where we are now, whether it's fracking, solar, battery chemistry, all of the above. It's a lot of work behind all that.
Yeah, definitely. And I think about all the people we don't hear about that did that work, you know, the champions of policies at the subnational level, you know, city, state level, federal level as well, people working on these technologies. That's what we see actually when we model technology evolution, is you really see the signature of the work that many people did in getting policies enacted, in working on the manufacturing floor, working in research labs. It wasn't a single innovator that brought us to where we are now. So I totally agree with you, Melissa, that was a lot of work by many different people that went into that.
So let's talk about EVs a bit, because I do think that issue of transport, as you say, Melissa, is very interesting in that, as of last year, emissions were not falling, but there's some pretty positive trends in terms of EV sales. I've been really struck by what seems to be this huge disconnect between the narrative and the data on EVs. Prevailing narrative has been, oh, industry is a disaster, everything's going terribly wrong and so on. I mean, certainly it is true that growth in sales last year perhaps was not as great as some people hoped it would be. But still, it's pretty remarkable. I was looking at the data. These are the Argonne National Laboratories figures, and that has sales of battery electric vehicles and plug-in hybrids, so what you might call plug-in vehicles in total, up to about 1.3 million in the US last year. That's up 54%. And that compares to 47% growth in 2022. So it's actually an acceleration, not a slowing down of growth. And it is true that we've seen some of the manufacturers scaling back their targets, people thinking perhaps they were over-optimistic a couple of years ago. I see Mercedes just recently said that they'd now expected only about 50% of its sales to be EVs by 2030. And 3 years ago, they were saying they hoped to maybe possibly be at 100% EVs by 2030. So perhaps the pace of the transition is slowing, but still it does feel like there is a big change happening, and it is still making progress in quite a remarkable way. And Melissa, what do you think? What's your sense of it in terms of where that transition to EVs is heading?
I mean, I think there's a lot of momentum behind EVs. It's not just because of climate. It's not just because they're fun to drive. It's not just because the cost makes sense. It's not just because the maintenance is really nice. It's not just because of any one thing. There's just a lot of stuff that's putting wind in the sails of EVs. We can hyper-focus on individual companies at individual moments in time, but when I just zoom out a lot, there's a lot of EVs on the road now in the United States and around the world, and they make a lot of sense on many, many different levels. They are certainly a key technology to bringing emissions down over time. But where I think of it is, and I'll just focus on the US because those are the numbers I was talking about earlier. We have a lot of electric vehicles going into the system, and we're now pressure testing our systems, and we're now putting a lot of additional impetus between figuring out how are we upgrading our grids. And I'm not just talking about the big wires. I'm actually not talking about the big wires right in this moment. I'm talking about the small wires that connect to the individual charging stations, that connect to our homes where we might have a home charger. I mean, this week is full of, whether you're on Blue Sky, Twitter, other things, lots of discussion about transformers and, you know, distributed energy systems and all of that for a lot of obvious reasons. And within that, it's, are we actually investing enough in our power system, the backbone of our future energy systems, to actually ensure that it's affordable and reliable. So I think we're still not far enough along in those conversations, the practical conversations of what we need to do and how we need to do it. But I'm not in the camp of, the evidence is not pointing me towards a place where I think that these systems are going to prevent EVs from continuing to deploy. It may slow a few things down, but it won't prevent them from deploying.
Right. And just in case anyone hasn't been following that debate about transformers that you mentioned, Melissa, this is basically...
Sorry, nerdy comment.
Exactly. Of course, everyone knows about transformers. But you're right to say that everyone in the energy world, certainly in the power world, has been talking about it. There is essentially a worldwide shortage of transformers, particularly because of tremendous demand now as people want to invest more in the grid and need to build that out more for a variety of reasons. It's very, very hard to get hold of a transformer, and the waiting lists are incredibly long. And that does look like a real kind of choke point in the transition, is the lack of transformer manufacturing capacity. And if it's possible to find ways to increase that capacity, that could be a very significant step forward. So going back to EVs then, Jessica, that's something you were writing about recently. And again, to that Melissa's point about all the reasons to buy an EV, I saw you writing a piece saying switching to an EV is one of the most impactful changes that an individual can make to reduce their personal contribution to climate change. Why is that? What's the argument there?
So that's based on looking at the life cycle, what are called the life cycle emissions of driving an EV versus internal combustion engine vehicle, a conventional vehicle. And when you see that, you know, accounting for all of the emissions from the electricity and the production of the battery, the production of the vehicle, if you switch to an electric vehicle, even if you don't change your driving habits, you can cut your emissions by 30 to 50%. In the U.S. So that's accounting for your emissions from driving, let's be clear, not your overall emissions, but your emissions from driving. And that's accounting for the variation, that number, that range is because of the variation in emissions intensity of electricity in different parts of the country. But in the vast majority of places, you're getting this very substantial cut in emissions. I mean, even in places where you have the most coal, the highest carbon intensity electricity in the country, you still get a substantial cut in emissions in switching to either a hybrid or an EV. But in most places around the country, it's going to an all-electric vehicle gives you that benefit of reducing your greenhouse gas emissions substantially and up to 50, and in some places even more. It depends on the vehicle model and so forth.
Right. That is interesting because that's been debated a bit, right? There were some studies probably a few years ago showing that perhaps the gains weren't all that great. And obviously, it depends what kind of EV you drive. And as you say, it depends very much what the source of your electricity is. Presumably, as electricity in general in the US becomes cleaner, lower carbon, then the emissions benefits of driving an EV are going to grow.
Yeah, that's right. So as the carbon intensity of electricity, you know, the carbon from electricity comes down, those benefits increase. But even today, you get this substantial increase, the substantial cut in emissions in switching to an electric vehicle. So that's really been shown exhaustively. The serious studies all show this. So it's really not a question. It's just that I think it's important to say because that information isn't always widely recognized. And so, and it can be a little bit counterintuitive because, you know, of course, we haven't fully decarbonized our electricity. So where is that coming from? Well, it's comparison of the carbon intensity of electricity versus the carbon intensity of using gas or diesel.
The other thing you were saying in that piece is that there is still clearly a role for government policy in supporting EVs and incentivizing people to buy them. Does that point to a failure in the EV industry that costs, you know, the industry has kept talking about the point where it will be very obvious that EVs are significantly cheaper than equivalent gasoline engine vehicles. And it hasn't really happened yet. They're probably still a bit more expensive in the US and Europe, certainly. It looks like maybe we're getting to that point in China. There's some pretty amazing things coming out of China, even just in the past few weeks. If you look at new EVs being launched, very, very low cost EVs, when you see what some of the manufacturers are saying about the costs of batteries. I saw one, I think it was Leapmotor, saying that it was paying the equivalent of $56 per kilowatt hour for lithium ferrophosphate cells, the sort of the lower cost type of lithium ion battery. It always used to be kind of talked about in the industry that $100 per kilowatt hour was that was the sort of the holy grail. That was what everyone was going for. And now we have one of these Chinese companies saying they're well below that. So it does seem like maybe in China, super low cost EVs are coming, but they haven't really emerged yet in the US and Europe. And so they do need various kinds of incentives still to support them. Is that a worrying sign for the industry? I mean, obviously, problem with needing policy to support the deployment of a technology is that policy can change. It's quite possible that we get a change of administration in the US. Former President Donald Trump has talked a lot about how he doesn't like EVs, and I'm sure he will be doing whatever he can if he gets another term to try and slow the growth of the EV industry. Doesn't that create fundamentally then a problem for EV deployment, which is, say, if you're reliant on policy, you're vulnerable to that policy being taken away?
Yeah, I guess I'll come back to some of what we've discussed on the topic of EVs, both what you said, Ed, and also what you said, Melissa, and this question of where is the market going? What do the trends say? And When we look at the improvement in the cost of EVs, this is driven largely by this exponential improvement in the cost of lithium-ion batteries. And that's really brought down the cost of EVs so that they're more affordable. The upfront costs are still a bit higher than the internal combustion engine upfront costs, but the overall costs of ownership are comparable. You know, that depends a bit, again, on the types of models and the features you're looking for and so forth. And then if we look at the growth in the market for EVs, you really do see this exponential growth across different markets. Some countries are further advanced in that along that growth curve. So Norway, for example, China, the EU, more so than the US. But even in the US, we see that exponential growth. So although there is a lot of discussion about these short-term changes, so the noise and those trends, when you look at the overall trends, that's what you see. And I think that will continue. Now, the question about policy and will policy change, of course, we can't answer that right now, but changes to policy could have important impacts. As I wrote in that Newsweek piece that you mentioned, policy is really important for ensuring that this transition is equitably beneficial to citizens in the U.S. and to people living in the U.S. and in other countries as well, because, you know, there has been public funds going into the development of these technologies because they provide this benefit to society of reducing greenhouse gas emissions and because we don't have a price on carbon. So that externality isn't priced. So the technology has improved, but it's more accessible to wealthier individuals. So you really need that policy to even things out so that it's more widely accessible. You also need that targeted funding in electric vehicle charging infrastructure. And this can be particularly important, again, for less wealthier households and households that would like to purchase one car for all of their uses. And that's overall better for the environment. It's also a necessity for many people. And of course, if you don't drive a car and you bike and you take public transit, that's the best option for climate change. But the third reason that policy is really important is to determine national competitiveness. So if we want to really stay competitive, become competitive in these rapidly developing markets, and the EV market, the charging infrastructure market is no exception, then, you know, the way to go is really to support that development. And so the policies that have been adopted also are targeting that national competitiveness. So those three reasons are, I think, strong arguments for policy in this space, because the markets are changing no matter what. I mean, regardless of what government does, it's just, again, this question of how quickly is the change going to happen? Is it going to be fast enough to address climate change? And then who's going to benefit? And are we putting government funds in the right places to benefit society?
Yeah, and the benefits around, I mean, we can take the Justice 40 lens, we can take a number of lenses, it's just one example. It's like, who has access to the opportunities presented by the transition? And how are we thinking about the risks and where those impacts will come? Going back to something, I don't think I didn't know this. I just think it wasn't in front of my face when I was thinking about energy systems 25 years ago, let's say, it's just a ballpark. Every single thing we do has trade-offs. The energy transition involves building a lot of stuff. Every one of those things has trade-offs. We are switching one set of things for another set of things in some cases. And overall, we're making those choices that they are better for us in our lives. So not mitigating climate change, worse than mitigating, but there's still trade-offs with that, which is a really important point. One thing I'll say, Jessica, I actually got a cracked windshield on my Tesla. Man, it was a big rock that caught it. Had to go get that windshield. I like the phrase windscreen, I will say, after living in Europe. I think it's a good one. So Ed, just shout out to you for that. But the windscreen got replaced yesterday. The cameras got all calibrated. Walking in and out of the service center, which is very conveniently next to a train station that connects to the city. I loved that. That was amazing. Were a bunch of Teslas for lease. And I was looking at this number 3 in front of the, you know, it was like 359, 379, those types of numbers. And thinking about my monthly cost around the fuel I put in my car and all this other stuff. And I was like, wow. And these were pretty fancy Teslas that I was looking at. They looked pretty fancy, but it was just thinking about how the overall ecosystem has changed, grown, and how the technologies combined with the incentives have put us in a position where not everyone, still, there are lots of barriers, absolutely, but more people have the opportunity to benefit from this technology than did in the past. And I'm curious to see what we're going to do to proactively accelerate the access to those opportunities, to access to these technologies moving forward.
The final thing I just wanted to talk about very quickly, because there's something else that you work on, Jessica, I think is really interesting, but just like to address briefly, is your research into soft costs, which seemed like a huge sort of underexplored issue in the energy transition. Do you want to explain what you're working on and what the significance of it is? Because as I say, I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, so we started to look at soft costs because they're a really important part and a high fraction of the total costs of clean energy projects today. So they can be up to 50% of the cost of installing and completing a construction project in the clean energy space.
And just as a very basic thing, what is a soft cost? What counts as soft and what doesn't?
So let's start with the costs of hardware are the costs of the physical technologies that you install as part of a project. The soft costs are everything else. So it's the cost of the labor to install those pieces of physical hardware. It's the cost of, let's say, there are delays in permitting. There's a cost associated with that. There's an overhead and so forth. It's the cost of interconnection delays. There's always some amount of delay, but if that's extended, you have costs with kind of keeping these projects going and maintaining these firms and their activities and so forth. And so those are all soft costs. But when we started to look at soft costs, we realized that it was useful to kind of break this whole question down at a different level because we were looking at, you know, what gives rise to these soft costs. We found it was more useful to think about hardware and soft technology and the features of those. And I won't go into it because it's a bit complicated, but soft costs are affected by the features of hardware and soft technology. But what's really slowing the improvement in soft costs is the soft technology. And so that's really everything that we can put in the bucket of codified knowledge that provides a service, but it doesn't take on a physical form. So it can be information contained in software. It can be information shared orally among a group of people. It can be written down as a checklist. And it's what you need to install hardware in a construction project, for example. So we started looking into that, and it turns out it's super important for determining the costs of these projects. And I think it can be improved. But we haven't been modeling it explicitly. So that's what we proposed a way to do that with my colleagues, with Magdalena Claymoon, who's a former graduate student and now a professor at the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology, also with Gökçen Kavlak and James McNerney, who are at the Brattle Group and Lincoln Labs, respectively, and former group members, too.
So I guess when people think about soft costs, they often think about regulation and dealing with kind of government processes and getting permits secured and all that kind of thing. But from what you're saying, there's a lot more to it than that. It's a much broader issue.
Yeah, so it's the cost of customer acquisition. It's the cost of labor. And what I should say is another important reason to consider soft technology is that you don't necessarily want to bring down all soft costs. There are certain variables defining soft technology that you actually might want to increase, like wages, but you might want to also improve the efficiency of tasks. You know, many people working in these projects report that they would like to avoid delays. So it actually decreases worker satisfaction to have these delays that increase the soft costs. So this is another reason why we want to look at soft technology and the variables underlying those costs, because when we're thinking about improving technology, we want to think not just about costs, but of course, other factors like job creation, job quality, worker satisfaction, and so forth.
And so at the highest level then, do you have any conclusions yet about, as you say, addressing those, perhaps not all the soft costs, but certainly the ones that ought to come down, addressing them in order to reduce the cost of clean energy overall?
I think there's a lot we can do, and some of the policy efforts around increasing the rate of allocating permits is really important. There are firms that are working on reducing delays in their processes and codifying information better. From a research perspective, we're working on modeling these soft technologies to really identify where the challenges are and where we could do better. This, by the way, is also really important for nuclear fission, but many other clean energy projects as well, in solar energy, wind energy, electric vehicle charging, and so forth. But by being more deliberate about how we're addressing soft technology as researchers, but then also firms, I think you can make a lot of progress. And when we see the companies that are winning the large contracts for offshore wind, for charging infrastructure expansion, they are ones that it looks like, again, some of this data is proprietary, but it looks like they are ones that have more effectively developed their soft technology. So I think part of what we need to do is just shine a light on this issue, be more deliberate about the soft technology, and really innovate in this area by modeling it through innovation in the private sector. I think we're going to see startups and mature companies perhaps focusing more deliberately on these issues. This challenge of soft costs obviously isn't new, but I think we have the potential now with access to information, the ability to store information, better software, even AI, that can allow us to make more progress on this issue. Not everything can be put into software. There are other kinds of soft technologies that are going to remain in this clean energy ecosystem for a while, I expect. And those can also be improved. But you can see improvements through deliberately adopting certain kinds of software.
So I had one example, and just I think this is right in line with what you're talking about, soft costs, is my heater went out. I want to replace my boiler with a heat pump. I need a permit. That permit process will take 3-6 weeks, something more than 48 hours because, you know, those processes take time. Well, we have actual processes that can pre-screen applications and do essentially automatic approvals where this is straightforward. You're taking your home heating system and converting it to electric. Here's the standard things you need to do. As long as you've done that and you have licensed contractors, et cetera, you should be good to go. I'm oversimplifying the process, but essentially transitioning it to be automatic instead of having to have multiple people reviewing it, which just takes time and a lot of labor workforce, which having worked in government, I mean, you're always trying to figure out how you can best use the resources you have, which are always limited. So that, I mean, it's beyond a soft cost, right? The time just makes it so I don't end up replacing the thing I have with a brand new tech in some cases, because I'm not going to wait that long to get it done. So that's just one example that Ed, I live with in the work that I do.
Yeah, it's a fascinating subject. That issue of regulator approvals and so on is really interesting. And I do think we should come back to it in a future show. Unfortunately, we do have to leave it there. Jessica, just before we let you go very quickly, do you have a free electron for us, a personal item you brought in?
I guess I just wanted to mention that it's been really interesting to see over the years how the discussion of these topics has really made it into the popular press, into topics of conversations at social gatherings. And in government, there's a lot more knowledge. You know, in the last presidential election season, there was a lot more coverage of climate change and energy. And so overall, I'm optimistic that these issues are becoming more widely known, more widely discussed. And that's just a thought I wanted to leave with after this discussion that we've had.
Yeah, no, it is a great point. And thank you very much for your contribution to increasing public understanding by talking to us today. Although actually I have a caveat to that, which is going to be my free electron. But Melissa, before I get to that, what's yours?
Ed, you can't set that up. I want to know what your free electron is. So I think you go next. I'll go after you. What are you about to say?
So mine is a complaint about the lack of public understanding here, as expressed in the final episode of True Detective Season 4, which was in general quite a controversial show. In general, I very much enjoyed it. I thought it was terrific. And I enjoyed the final episode. The denouement, I thought, was actually very clever. But there was something that very much annoyed me right at the end, where I think we've discussed this before, maybe not with you, Melissa, on the show, but I've been talking about how the mining company is the big bad guy in the season, or kind of one of them, part of it. Apologies for spoilers there, everyone who hasn't seen it yet, but I think it's not a massive surprise if you see it. Anyway, this mining company is described as polluting at levels that are, I think they say, 11 times greater than our allowed by the UNFCCC and the Vienna Convention. And I'm afraid that did kind of set my feelings jangling a bit. I mean, the UNFCCC, as we all know, does not work like that, doesn't set limits on pollution, certainly doesn't say anything about local pollution. The Vienna Convention also is one from 1985. That's one about the ozone layer. It's the original sort of convention say that the world needed to do something about CFCs and so on. So anyway, just like linking that to mine pollution just kind of raised my hackles a bit. It wouldn't have been that hard to find something that was right. Why did they have to just get it so totally wildly wrong? So that's, as I say, when I'm writing the angry letter in green ink to complain to the producers of True Detective and the HBO network, I'm going to be saying, generally you did okay, but that was a bit of a bum note that I did not really appreciate.
Oh, Emily Grubert, if you're listening, I think it's you that I've nerded out with about this, but when we see like infrastructure in movies, I've nerded out with Emily and a lot of other people actually about this one. And you see a power plant and they're like, oh, it's a nuclear power plant. And you're like, nope, coal, you know, or nope, natural gas, or nope, something else. There was one, I can't remember, I'm going to have to find this movie and rewatch it. And I'm thinking from memory, I didn't like it because they had a geothermal power plant and they called it a coal power plant. And I was just like, no, it's not. it's just one of those things where I love it when TV shows and movies and stuff get like science advisors and technical advisors, whatever it is. It could be someone who's worked in politics advising on West Wing or something like that's overly dramatic, not just pushing the edges, those types of things. But on the tech, it's like, nope, that's not a nuclear power plant you're looking at right now. It's a personal pet peeve of mine. So there you go. But I have something way less. Well, no, I'm not going to say it's way less cool. It's a different type of cool than something connected to pop culture, Ed. But I appreciate it. I've never watched any True Detective. We'll discuss that offline. Maybe I need to. Maybe I don't. But I just wanted to give a shout out to Harry Kennard, who I work with at the Center on Global Energy Policy. But I've worked with him for a number of years. He actually supported work that I did with Ian Hamilton and a bunch of people from the University College London and the Lancet Countdowns, all the work I do in public health and climate and energy and how we think about the co-benefits of going to net zero. But the shout out I'm going to give is that Harry actually submitted some formal comments in response to a Department of Energy request because the DOE is proposing a national definition of a zero emission building. And we all know how important definitions are to setting up things from then on. Like, what is it? How do we define it? I remember giving a TEDx talk, 12, 14 years ago, where it's like, what is the smart grid? Let's talk it out. You know, we think we know what we're talking about, but are we saying the same thing? What's the definition? So it's available online for anyone who wants to read it, but it was responding to questions like, are the draft criteria from the DOE appropriate for defining a zero emissions building? Should there be any other criteria? And what is the role of energy efficiency? Like, where does that come in? How required? How important is it? You could have a zero emission building that was, you know, a leaky sieve, as it were, when it came to insulation, as an example. But is that really what we're going for? You know, how should we think about building performance? But Harry, and then also Ian Hamilton, who I mentioned from UCL, who works with the center as a distinguished visiting fellow here at Columbia, they are experts on the built environment, the buildings we live and work in every day. I mean, they work around the world on this. So just a big shout out to Harry. And if we have listeners who are really into how we define zero emission buildings, how we think about the future of the built environment, just would point you towards that. It's available on our website.
And that is really cool. You're right. Arguably even cooler than the True Detective series.
Different cool. Different type of cool. Different cool.
So we do, unfortunately, have to leave it there. But thanks very much, Melissa, for joining us.
Thanks, Ed. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Jessica, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I hope we will see you again soon. And thanks to our producers, Sam Nash, Roxy Ibrahim Khan, and Toby Biggins-Gilchrist. And above all, of course, many thanks to all of you for listening. Please do keep your feedback coming. Find us on all the usual social media platforms. And we'll be back in 2 weeks with all the latest news and views on the energy transition. Until then, goodbye.